Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our analysts, Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University, in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Jonathan Hasid is in our Ames studio, associate professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, hello to you.
Hi, Ben.
I want to reach out to our listeners, as always, especially during Politics Day. If you would like to join in our conversation, note this number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. In the first half hour, we'll be talking about the debate over gun policy, now more than 2 weeks after those mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton. Let's talk about that now, because we've seen what is being described as a shift, a backing away from what the president said in the days following those weekend shootings in Texas and Ohio. He said then, days after, that he was prepared to endorse what he described as very meaningful background checks. Let's listen to the president. August 9th, less than a week after the gunman in El Paso and Dayton opened fire, killing more than 30 and wounding more than 50. Here's the president then.
Frankly, we need intelligent background checks, okay? This isn't a question of NRA, Republican, or Democrat. I will tell you, I spoke to Mitch McConnell yesterday. He's totally on board. He said, I've been waiting for your call. He is totally on board. I spoke to senators that in some cases, people, friends of mine, but pretty hardline senators, hardline. And when I say that in a positive way. Hardline on the Second Amendment. And they understand we don't want insane people, mentally ill people, bad people, dangerous people. We don't want guns in the hands of the wrong people. I think that the Republicans are going to be great and lead the charge along with the Democrats. I spoke yesterday to Nancy Pelosi. We had a great talk. I spoke to Chuck Schumer. We had a great talk on background checks. We have tremendous support for really common sense, sensible, important background checks.
That was August 9th. Here's the president speaking in the Oval Office yesterday after meeting with the chief executive of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre.
We have very, very strong background checks right now, but we have sort of missing areas and areas that don't complete the whole circle. And we're looking at different things. And I have to tell you that it is a mental problem. And I've said it 100 times. It's not the gun that pulls the trigger. It's the person that pulls the trigger. These are sick people.
Okay. And then this morning, President Trump says his administration would seek to fill in background check loopholes for gun purchases, this time coming after Democrats accusing him of reversing course on gun control measures. Okay, a quick survey of what happened in the last few days. Rachel, pick up with your thoughts about what we've seen after those horrible shootings and the political aftermath.
Well, this is virtually exactly what we saw after the Parkland shooting. So I think this is true to script. When there's an immediate sense of a problem within the population, the president will jump forward and say, hey, we're going to fix this. Remember that the president can't do this alone, of course, with his typical bluster and hyperbole. And then after some reflection and talking to some people who he knows supports him, he'll step back and he'll say, wait a minute, I never meant that. And we end up with a lot of status quo.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Hasid, are you tracking this the same way Rachel is?
I am. You know, he's a very reactive politician. You know, he reacts to what's happening around him. He reacts to attacks. He reacts to events. And there's not necessarily a lot of strategy behind each of these reactions. But then when the immediate furor dies down, he talks to his base, and his base says, you know, we're upset. Wayne LaPierre of the NRA says we're upset with this proposal, and then he just backs off. As Rachel said, he's done this before. He said after, I forget, one of the mass shootings. There are so many mass shootings, it's hard to keep track. But he said after one of them that, you know, just go ahead and grab the guns first and have due process second. And then he immediately walked that back because, of course, that didn't go over well with supporters of the Second Amendment. So this is just, you know, typical Trump being Trump.
Also, but we've seen in the meantime, in more recent months, the NRA having problems. This week, I think several more NRA leaders stepped down amid the controversy. I don't know how much either of you have been following it. I've only been sort of reading various parts of it, that the controversy over the NRA's spending. I wonder if Rachel, if you can talk about the problems the NRA has been having recently. Are they going to impact the well-known political influence of the NRA in Washington?
Well, you know, if you look at a list of how interest groups exercise influence, and a lot of people just distill it down to money, but there are so many resources that are brought to bear in these sorts of political battles that are fought over a long period of time, including most notably people. And the NRA has voters in every state and every congressional district across the country. They have money. They have a strong narrative that they've created over the past several decades. And they have this incredibly strong, cohesive organizational structure. It's that strong organizational structure that is beginning to fall apart through this mismanagement of resources. They're under investigation now by state attorneys general, and facing real concerns and questions at the leadership level about how the money has been spent and whether or not they've been following relevant state laws in filing information about how, you know, the money that they collect and the money that they spend. They're kind of a fantastic story about Wayne LaPierre wanting to buy a massive piece of property to ensure his safety, the amount of money that is spent on his clothing and transportation and things like that. What the NRA continues to have, however, is it continues to have voters in every state and every congressional district across the country. And those voters have been deeply connected to the organization and the cause for a very long time. And of course, there's more or less support depending on the congressional district. But until those voters start to abandon the NRA's cause, the NRA will continue to be a potent electoral force. The question is, will these shootings and the growing single-issue voter on the anti-gun front, on the gun control front, will that change the electoral calculus? In other words, will some of those people shift away from their strong support of gun rights?
Today, we also heard in the top of the hour news here on NPR that the March for Our Lives, we've had Iowa representatives of March for Our Lives on this program. This is the group led by student survivors of the shooting massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. In Florida, they unveiled today an ambitious gun control program, one that would ban assault-style weapons, also raise the minimum wage for buying firearms, also create a national gun registry and require gun owners to pay for new licenses each year. Obviously, these this plan going well beyond the gun control measures like the so-called red flag laws and expanded background checks. Jonathan, let me turn to you and ask, you know, what about what is the how do you see the state of the groups trying to push for a more stringent gun policy in this country, like March for Our Lives?
I do think there seems to be some momentum on the on the gun control side. As Rachel said, the NRA is sort of seems to be slowly losing perhaps some of its influence. Certainly its money is drying up. They're running horrible budget deficits, and that will just, you know, help in terms of any general electoral campaign. So in 2016, the NRA poured a tremendous millions of dollars into Trump's Trump's election bid, and they just won't have the resources to do that again. And as she alluded to, there do seem to be more single-issue. So historically, single-issue voters on guns have all been pro-Second Amendment people, or virtually all. Now there seem to be more single-issue voters, that is to say, people whose number one priority is gun control, coming after in the wake of these, you know, one mass shooting after another. And if you look at opinion polls, a lot of the things that the Parkland Survivor Group is proposing are actually quite popular. And so the big impediment here isn't the American population as a whole, right? It's institutional interests inside the GOP and groups like the NRA. And to the extent that they're weakening, there may be a bit of a change here, which hasn't happened in a long time.
To just jump on what you were saying, a new survey finding that the majority of Americans, this includes gun owners and Republicans, According to this survey, supporting laws that would allow family members or law enforcement to request temporary removal of guns from a person who is seen to be a risk to themselves or to others. This is new research by the APM Research Lab Guns and America Call to Mind survey. These are often called red flag laws or called extreme risk protection orders, order laws. They've received this new attention after these latest shootings. Now, to a couple details from this survey, overall, 77% of Americans surveyed support these family-initiated extreme risk protection orders. 70% support them when initiated by law enforcement. That's according to this survey. So we have broad support among Republicans and gun owners for these types of laws. The poll finding 2/3 of Republicans, 60% of gun owners supporting allowing police to seek court orders, these so-called red flag laws. Let's listen to Governor Kim Reynolds asked yesterday about growing support for these so-called red flag laws. Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley has said he supports this concept of temporarily blocking access to guns when a person shows signs of violence. Reynolds here declining to say she would support such a measure.
We'll take a look at it, but it's just we have to get past this looking at the gun or looking at one thing and letting people think that that's the answer, because it's not. I mean, that's almost instituting a false sense of security, and I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what do you make of that comment by the governor?
Well, it strikes me that, you know, Governor Reynolds, like a lot of people around the country right now, are trying to sift through a lot of claims on her attention and her political capital. So at this point, she seems unwilling to invest in this particular policy solution. And, you know, as her administration looks at a wide range of potential policy responses and judges public support for those policy responses, then, you know, that's when you start to nail down a specific policy position on those issues. So I think at this point she's just sort of, you know, entering the debate quietly and not willing to commit to anything specific.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add there, Jonathan, before we move on?
I mean, this is a tough issue for her and for a lot of sort of moderate or mainstream Republicans, right? Because they have very strong, passionate Second Amendment support. It was a big driver of the GOP. This sort of set against the large majority of the American population, which is for more gun control measures, although arguably less passionately than the gun rights people are. And so, it puts her in a tough position. And I can understand why she wouldn't want to wade into these, you know, shark-filled waters.
Bruce is joining us from Iowa City. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Bruce, in Iowa City, you want to weigh in on this issue? Welcome.
Yes, well, thank you, Ben. I just wanted to comment that I think there is pushback among gun control advocates on, for example, Joni Ernst. I don't know if you saw a video of a recent town hall that she held, I think, in Johnston, in which a teacher asked questions. She said, when can I get back, meaning the teacher, when I can get back, can I get simply back to teaching children to read and write, mm-hmm. rather than going through these active shooting drills? And Ernst began to reply by saying, well, we need more mental health counseling. And we need to, even though there's been a reduction of mental health counselors, went the sort of Trump route of saying it's a mental illness. Well, the audience replied extremely vigorously, saying, well, no, we want you to do something. And as she tried to continue on the mental health train of thought, they began to boo her and call her out. So I'm wondering whether or to what extent this might actually represent a kind of fervent response on those people who want more gun control, that may be as perhaps as fervent as those who want to protect what they say is protect the Second Amendment rights. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to mm-hmm. put that out there that she's receiving some significant pushback based upon the video evidence that I got to see that's easily readily available.
Bruce, I actually did see the same clip that mm-hmm. That you're talking about as well, and we've had the leader of NAMI Iowa on this program to talk about that that idea that you know that these people are readily identifiable as having diagnosable mental conditions that you can weed out easily, Rachel. This is just, Bruce is perhaps referring to what is becoming perhaps a more nuanced view of mental health and mental illness and its connection with background checks.
And a coalescing of interests around gun control. We're seeing more and more voters, as Jonathan indicated, right? We're seeing more and more voters come out and say, you know, we can talk about mental health and we need to talk about mental health, but we also need to talk about gun control and trying to redirect the conversation back to this issue. And that's a relatively new development. It's changing a public conversation that's been going on for a long time. And that conversation for decades has been dominated by the NRA. And we're seeing groups come around very quickly and start to form around the idea that gun control needs to be a priority in our political discourse.
Right. And when we pivot here through the lens of the 2020 Democratic presidential race, we've had more than two dozen pushing for tighter gun restrictions. The NRA accusing these presidential candidates of trying to politicize the mass shootings and warning against enhanced background checks for gun buyers. What are you hearing out of the 2020 campaign, Jonathan, regarding gun checks?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the candidates, as you said, are interested in pushing for more stringent gun control regulation. And as we've said, you know, they seem to have the support of not just Democrats, but for a lot of these measures, the broad majority of the American populace. I think probably it'll put some of them in a little bit of a tough position. You know, the theme of the Democratic nomination so far has been a sort of a run to the left. Perhaps if they go, if some of them go too far on this, it may, if they make it out to the general, it may hurt them a little bit there. But then there are others like Bernie Sanders, who historically has had a lot of support for gun rights. Vermont is a state with a lot of gun ownership. To the extent that this issue gains salience inside the Democratic Party, it's possible that it could end up hurting him a little bit because of his sort of historic reluctance to do gun control measures.
If you just joined us, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. We have about 5 minutes before we take our break halfway through. Let's talk about this quickly. The Trump administration continuing, of course, to say that the economy is strong, but now also calling for dramatic economic stimulus. Yesterday, Donald Trump confirming that he was considering various tax reductions, including a payroll tax cut to stimulate the economy. That seems to be beginning to slow. Let's listen to the president yesterday in the Oval Office after economic indicators begin to show signs of a slowing economy.
I've been thinking about payroll taxes for a long time. Whether or not we do it now or not is it's not being done because of recession, because we are legitimately, if we had a cut in interest rates by the Fed, if they would do their job properly, and if they would do a meaningful cut because they raised too fast, you would see growth like you've not seen ever in this country.
Okay, Jonathan, let me go to you first on this one. What do you hear in the president's talk there?
Well, he actually walked this back right as I was walking over to the studio this morning.
That's right.
So he said, quote, this morning, he said,
oh, so, okay.
Yeah, so this is already, he's reversed himself since yesterday. He said, quote, I'm not looking at a tax cut now. It's not something that I love. And of course, yesterday he said, quote, we're always looking at the capital gains tax, payroll tax. I would love to do something on capital gains. So he went from going in love with doing tax cuts to out of love over the course of about 12 hours.
Yeah, right.
In any case, this is not something you can do unilaterally. It requires, obviously, Congress to do any kind of tax cuts. Nancy Pelosi, who is, of course, the House Speaker, may be willing to do tax cuts, but she's going to extract a pound of flesh for them. Trump isn't going to get these for free.
So even these payroll taxes would not be something he can, by executive decree, happen.
Correct. So he argues that he can, on capital gains and on payroll taxes, that he can, without congressional approval, index them to inflation, which would amount to, over time, a pretty big tax cut. However, the Attorney General Barr, when he was Attorney General before in the 80s, came out with an opinion saying that this has to be done through Congress and it can't be done unilaterally. And so it'd be a little awkward for Barr to then turn around and say, no, actually, I was wrong. We can do this without congressional approval.
Barr
Although anything is possible.
Anything is possible. That's right.
He appears to have eliminated his wiggle room as the attorney general here. What do you see here, Rachel?
I think Jonathan's exactly right. This is one of those circumstances the White House, a number of White House spokespeople had said, nope, not considering this. The president then said, yep, we're considering this. Then the president this morning said, nope, we're not considering this. I think as much as anything, and this has come up repeatedly for the president, he would really like to pressure the Fed to lower interest rates. And you heard that as part of his comments. And so throwing out these other possibilities, I think, is kind of a way to say, yep, we're looking at a lot of different possible answers, but there's no real problem. So we're just going to kind of keep this on the back burner for the time being. But it keeps his supporters interested. It keeps the business community interested. And it's a way in some respects, it's a way to answer some of the Democrats' concerns about working Americans.
Okay. We have a couple of callers on the line. Listeners, we're coming up on a break. We'll have to ask you to make it quick. Jeremy in Des Moines, welcome to the program. Please be brief. Get right to it. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. I think you're seeing a lot of support for red flag laws because, they're well-intended. People hear a basic summation of what a red flag law is and what the intent of it. What it would intend to accomplish, and they think that's a good thing. The problem is that is twofold. Number one, they're not always aware of existing laws, and they're not thinking about the unintended consequences. They're not thinking about how these laws are ripe for abuse. And I'll tell this as quickly as I can. There was a case in Florida very recently where a man was it was mistaken identity, a man who was a lawful concealed carry holder, because mm-hmm. they have red flag laws down there now. He had a lawful concealed carry license. He was a lawful gun owner, but he was mistaken. His identity was mistaken for a drug dealer of the same name. The drug dealer was the subject of a temporary restraining order, and because all that happened is when the police got the court order for the restraining order and they went to file it, all they did was they searched for a concealed carry license for a man with this name with a concealed carry license.
Okay.
They found
Jeremy,
it.
I'm going to have to cut you off. We're coming up on a break, Jeremy. I think we got the gist of your example there. Jeremy in Des Moines, thank you very much. We're going to go away and then come back with Jonathan Haseeb and Rachel Caulfield. It's Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River. Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Des Moines. When we come back, of course, Jonathan and Rachel will be with us as well, but we'll continue our Home State View series with a focus today on Montana Governor and Democratic presidential candidate Steve Bullock. A short conversation with Sally Mock of Montana Public Radio. That's when we return, and also we'll get Rachel and Jonathan's views on where we are in the 2020 race with still about two dozen Democratic candidates. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River Politics Wednesday. Jonathan Haseeb and Rachel Caulfield, back in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad to have you aboard. Today with political scientists Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University. We'll get back to more of their analysis in just a moment. But first, we want to continue with our 2020 caucus series we've been calling Home State View. This is where we learn about the 2020 candidates by talking with news media figures who have been covering them for some time in their home state. Today, a home state view of Montana Governor and Democratic presidential candidate Steve Bullock. Joining us to do that, Sally Mock is host of Campaign Beat on Montana Public Radio, also formerly news director for decades at Montana Public Radio. Sally Mock, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So what can you tell us about how Steve Bullock entered public life, rose to the office of governor?
Well, he took what is somewhat of a traditional route in Montana to be governor, and that is he ran for attorney general of the state and served in that office. And then after serving as AG, he became a candidate for governor and succeeded another Democratic governor.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the people he surrounds himself with, his team, and how he treats them.
His team is usually pulled from different sectors in Montana, whether it's business or environmental organizations or economic organizations. And generally, the people he surrounds himself with are people who have expertise in the area that they've been picked to head up. And generally, he's had a good team. He's had a couple of blips. He had a lieutenant governor that he apparently did not get along with, and she transferred out of the lieutenant governor's office to another state agency. There was some mystery around that about why the two of them didn't get along. But on the whole, he's had a staff that has respected him.
Mm-hmm. I understand he had a blip, in your words, also with another Democratic presidential candidate, the New York City Mayor de Blasio.
Yes, that was an interesting episode, actually. Governor Bullock had a staffer when he was governor named Kevin O'Brien, one of his key aides. And when the governor became president of head of the Democratic Governors Association, Kevin O'Brien also was hired by the DGA. But while there, he was accused of sexual harassment and fired. And then Mayor de Blasio picked him up to be one of his senior advisors in New York. And O'Brien was once again accused of sexual harassment. And when de Blasio found out that O'Brien had previously had that accusation and no one, including Governor Bullock, had given him a heads up, he was quite miffed at Governor Bullock. And the governor has since apologized, saying he should have given de Blasio a warning about his former staffer. His excuse was that he didn't think O'Brien would repeat the offense, but he did.
Mm-hmm. What do the citizens of Montana look to as Steve Bullock's biggest successes while in office?
I think he's probably most praised for his ability to work with a Republican legislature and to get things done, to be able to work across the aisle. He has, in both his terms as governor, managed to accumulate some moderate Republicans who were willing to compromise with him on some crucial issues, including continuing Medicaid expansion in Montana. That was no easy feat. So I think his ability to compromise and work with people who have a different political background than he does is probably seen as his greatest strength.
Right, and he sells that too. As coming from a red state, a Democratic governor is unusual.
It is, and I would say, though, that Montana has a history of having a Democratic administration and a Republican legislature, or vice versa. It's a state that is a little bit schizophrenic in its politics. But he has, I think, been probably one of the more successful governors in bridging those gaps.
Mm-hmm. When he has been criticized, what has it been for?
I think right now it's that he's running for president. A lot of Montana Democrats wish that he was running for the U.S. Senate and wish he was challenging the incumbent Republican Steve Daines. There isn't a strong candidate to challenge Daines at the moment. Bullock would be seen as someone who could possibly unseat the incumbent, probably the only one who could. So that's probably the thing they're most upset with him currently.
Mm. I wonder, since putting himself in the national spotlight as a Democratic presidential candidate, have you or other Montanans seen a change in the way he portrays himself, or has he altered any policies?
Well, he has definitely altered a couple of policies, most notably gun control. The governor, while he was governor and still is governor, of course, but during his administrations, has not come out in favor of any new gun control until he announced for president. And now he is in favor of, for example, universal background checks and a ban on assault weapons. That was something that he did not favor until he was running for president. So that's quite a change.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he's strong on climate change, but as governor, he was very, as most Montana governors have been, all of them actually, pro-coal, and someone who defended the coal industry. And I think as president, he certainly softened his stance on that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit how he is personally relating to voters in a room or at a rally. What is his appeal?
He's very likable in person. He has a warm smile. He definitely is someone that if you meet him, you have a good first impression of him. And he has gone around to the state and met, you know, it's a small state population-wise. There are only 1 million people in the whole state of Montana. So a politician here can meet a lot of those people face-to-face. And the governor's done that. And I think people find him very likable and personable and end up coming away thinking, wow, that's a good guy.
Okay. And finishing up, Sally Mock, can you tell us something about Steve Bullock, your governor there in Montana, that hasn't perhaps been so widely reported, a fun fact about his personality or his background?
Mm-hmm. I think one fun fact is that he grew up in Helena, Montana, or state capital, and as a kid, he delivered newspapers to the governor's mansion.
Oh!
And then went on, of course, to live in the governor's mansion, so that's kind of a fun fact.
That is. Sally Mock, host of Campaign Beat on Montana Public Radio, joining us from Missoula today. Sally Mock, thank you so much for this home state view of Montana governor and present Democratic presidential candidate Steve Bullock.
My pleasure, Ben. Nice to be with you.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Pivoting back to our analysts this hour, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, professor of political science. Jonathan Hasid, associate professor of political science at Iowa State University. Let's continue talking a little bit about the 2020 race. I'm seeing, at least in my news, Jonathan and Rachel, that 10 Democratic candidates now qualifying for that very important September debate. Biden, Booker, Buttigieg, Castro, Harris, Klobuchar, O'Rourke, Sanders, Warren, Yang. I think I got all 10 there. Steve Bullock, we just talked about him, not qualifying. And this is an interesting system, isn't it, Jonathan, that they have to have a polling and a fundraising requirement to reach the next level.
Right. And a lot of people haven't had enough small donors to meet the fundraising requirement. It's not just a dollar amount. It's a number of donors. And so if you're, very wealthy, like Tom Steyer, the billionaire, who's like apparently running for president also, you know, he can just write himself an enormous check, but it doesn't count.
Mm, yeah, because you have to have the number of separate donations. Rachel, what are your thoughts on how this system of qualifying for the debates devised by the Democrats, right, is shaping the field? Is it shaping the race fairly in a way the Democrats intended?
I think fairly is always one of those words that I try to stay away from, because I think any system that you use is going to advantage some candidates and disadvantage other candidates. And so it kind of depends on who you are if you think it's fair.
right.
In this case, I think what it's doing, first of all, it's emphasizing candidates who can maintain a national level reputation at this point, because candidates have to receive 130, they have to have 130,000 unique donors from 20 different states. And that means essentially that, you know, long ago, the myth of Iowa and Jimmy Carter coming to Iowa with very little national name recognition or money and getting his boost here, that candidate can no longer survive in this environment. You have to hit the ground running and be able to have the name recognition to raise money across a national electorate from day one in order to stay in the race. And I think that's a really significant change in the types of candidates who are going to do well in this system.
Right. So Iowa's significance has been dealt a major blow here.
Potentially, yeah.
Potentially. You say there's still,
we have a long way to go.
February 3rd is a ways off, isn't it? Okay.
It's a long way. We forget that sometimes, but we got a long way to go.
Of course, candidates in our state week by week, many of them every week. But on Monday, the Massachusetts senator running for president, Elizabeth Warren, publicly apologized to Native Americans for identifying as Native American and for her controversial DNA test. This is Monday at a president forum in Sioux City, apologizing for that DNA test. Let's listen.
I want to say this. like anyone who's being honest with themselves, I know that I have made mistakes. I am sorry for harm I have caused. I have listened and I have learned a lot. And I am grateful for the many conversations that we've had together.
Now, you may be saying, wait a minute, I thought Elizabeth Warren already apologized for it. Well, although the Cherokee Nation said Warren had apologized for the DNA test last year, apparently she had not done so publicly before Monday in Sioux City. Jonathan, comment on this. Why did she need to continue did she need this public apology here? This has been haunting her, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. I mean, apparently she felt she needed it. I mean, you know, it was clearly a misstep to do it. It made her sort of an instant laughing stock. And, you know, she's a serious candidate with a lot of very serious positions. And so it certainly wasn't good for her. It also, I mean, this issue isn't going to go away if she is the Democratic nominee in the general. I'm sure, you know, the president already refers to her as Pocahontas. And he's not going to stop doing that just because, you know, she's apologized for releasing the results of this DNA test. It was clearly a misjudgment. In her favor, the Boston Globe did a deep dive into whether or not she benefited in her career from being associated as Native American. And apparently they concluded after a lot of investigative reporting that she really hasn't. This is just an effort to clear the air. Whether or not it's successful, we'll have to see.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left. Let me make sure we get to you, Jonathan, because of your expertise on Asia, to talk about Hong Kong. The unrest continues unabated in Hong Kong, the former British colony, now a special administrative region in China. We've seen in our news for months Hong Kong streets seething with discontent. We see what protesters, sometimes hundreds of thousands, wearing these surgical masks, carrying umbrellas, which have symbolized the resistance. Give us some context here, Jonathan. How did this start? What is it about?
Well, what happened was the Hong Kong government proposed, under Chief Executive Carrie Lam, proposed a law that would make it easier to extradite suspects to, among other places, mainland China. And so this was seen as a way to get around Hong Kong's strong culture of the rule of law, the idea being that if China wanted someone from Hong Kong, they could just invoke this new law and essentially kidnap or grab them. And so this is what initially sparked off the protests, right? This was the event that touched it all off. But Hong Kong has been a powder keg for a long time. The people of Hong Kong are really, really dissatisfied with mainland China. And if you look at opinion polls that the University of Hong Kong has done every single year since Hong Kong reverted to mainland China since 1997, 1997 was actually the high watermark of people saying that they felt Chinese. Ever since 1997, every year the number of people who say they felt Chinese has dropped, and the number of people who say they felt that they have a Hong Kong identity has risen. And so essentially, this has been the opposite of what Beijing had hoped for. Beijing had hoped that they would sort of absorb Hong Kong over time. As it happens, the lines of identity have really hardened over time. And so the people in Hong Kong increasingly, many of them don't want to be, there's not really a strong independence movement, but they want to maintain their autonomy, and they see that Beijing is coming in and creeping and taking it away slice by slice. Mm-hmm. And this particular slice was the last straw for, as we've seen, hundreds of thousands and even up to 2 million people have protested.
Right, and quickly, how might this end? Of course, we wonder if China will use force to put down these protests, and of course, in the back of all of our minds, Tiananmen Square from 1989, when hundreds or maybe even thousands were killed. We're not sure, I don't think, on that number yet.
Indeed. The Chinese government has really stepped up its rhetoric in the past few weeks, and they've started massing, among other things, riot police and armored personnel carriers right outside the Hong Kong border in a city called Shenzhen. And so the government is threatening, Beijing is threatening sort of indirectly to go in with troops. But of course, everyone in Hong Kong, certainly, even if people in the mainland don't remember 1989, people in Hong Kong do. And it would be a world of hurt for Xi Jinping and Beijing if they did this. So I think what they hope is that the protests will die out of their own accord if they just let the mainland, the Hong Kong police handle it. I don't know if that's going to happen. It seems to me that the longer the protests go on, the higher the likelihood of some kind of bloody intervention by Beijing.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep with some foreign policy political news in these final few minutes of our program.
Jonathan and Rachel. We heard last night that Donald Trump said he's putting off a state visit to Denmark because the prime minister had said the Danish prime minister, had no interest in discussing the sale of Greenland. This is the tweet from Donald Trump, I think yesterday evening. Denmark is a very special country with incredible people, but based on Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen's comments that she would have no interest in discussing the purchase of Greenland, I will be postponing our meeting scheduled in 2 weeks for another time. Wow, what a reaction from the world, from Denmark.
I love it when I'm here for the wacky stories.
When you're on for these weeks.
Yes.
Yes. This is serving Denmark's first female prime minister from 2011 to 2015, former prime minister, expressing incredulity. Is this some sort of joke? She wrote on Twitter, deeply insulting to the people of Greenland and Denmark. Your thoughts on this whole episode, Rachel? I mean,
it's hard to formulate a lot of serious thoughts on this whole episode. I mean, this, from the very first moment that it was brought up, it's just, I don't know what would have initiated the president's initial comments. Or, I mean, apparently White House counsel has actually vetted the idea of buying Greenland.
Right.
You know, the president said this is going to be a massive real estate deal, basically. And it might have been, but I really have no words.
We're getting you to the point of speechlessness, which
really
is something
are.
For Rachel Caulfield,
that's right.
I have to say.
That's right. Jonathan,
this all started last week. We heard the Wall Street Journal break the news Thursday night that Trump had repeatedly quizzed aides on the possibility of buying Greenland. Denmark government's just saying Greenland is not for sale. Greenland is not Danish.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing, and the thing that Trump seems to be ignoring here, is that again, Greenland isn't for sale, right? I don't think the people of Greenland want to be Americans. I think they're happy being Danish and Greenlanders. And it's also, I don't know. I mean, it's nominally independent, but part of Denmark, right? There are no guns. They have universal health care. I mean, this is not something that's going to fit well culturally with the United States. I can't help but wonder if this is one of those ideas that the president has thrown out to distract from bad news. So we saw, last week the stock market had a big drop. There's something called the inverted yield curve that suggests that there might be a recession coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So this may be one of those wacky Donald Trump ideas that he just does to sort of distract everyone from other bad news.
All right. React in closing to this Politico headline. I was reading the article of it. The headline here, people don't want to be stupid twice. Foreign diplomats brace for Trump 2020 win. And I'll just read the first part, a few sentences here. Foreign diplomats still feeling burned after assuming Donald Trump would lose in 2016. And they don't want to be fooled again. So many of them are quietly preparing for and predicting a Trump victory in 2020. Some are even trying to game out who will be on the president's team in the second term. The belief that Trump will win re-election, gleaned from conversations with around 20 foreign diplomats, international officials, and analysts who deal with him, appears to be widespread. End of the quote from that Politico article. Jonathan, and then Rachel, weigh in on this. Jonathan, what do you think of this? I guess many of us are not aware to the degree to which the foreign diplomats were caught off guard by the Trump victory in 2016.
Sure, and they don't want to be caught off guard again. I mean, he is an incumbent president, right? He has a very strong base, which hasn't gone anywhere. And so, absolutely, the president could win re-election. Certainly he could. And so, the diplomats would be stupid not to prepare, right? They were caught flat-footed, as were lots of other people last time, including political scientists, I should add. And so they don't want to, I don't think you're going to get many diplomats or political scientists this time saying a Trump re-election is impossible.
Right. And at this point, we are far, far away even from the caucuses on February 3rd, Rachel. But, President Trump has a lot of things in his corner going for him in the re-election already, doesn't he?
He does. He has had strong economic indicators. Whether or not that economic performance continues is another question. But as an incumbent president, and right now, without knowing who the Democratic challenger is going to be, I think a lot of diplomats and leaders from other countries are looking around and saying, we need to plan ahead and kind of game out what the possible outcomes of this election are. And as Jonathan said, you know, it would be really short-sighted to ignore the possibility of a re-election. And in fact, you know, anybody who right now is assuming that the president loses re-election, I think, is making a big mistake.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield, thank you so much for being with us this hour. Jonathan Haseeb, thanks to both of you for stepping into your respective studios there.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Jonathan Haseeb, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Rachel Caulfield, Professor of Political Science at Drake University in Des Moines. Tomorrow on the program, I'm scheduled to speak with the UNI's President Nook at the start of this new academic season. Also, Iowa City declaring a climate crisis. I'll talk with the mayor of Iowa City, Mayor Throckmorton, among other guests. Tomorrow on this program, we hope you'll join us. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Shirley Wang, and Caitlin Harrop. Help today also from Stephanie Nobrega. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.